May we ask you to please be seated? The criteria set forth by our Presidential Search Committee in choosing a successor to our beloved Rebbe, Dr. Samuel Belkin Zatzal, were indeed high standards. Yeshiva University's president, we said, should possess outstanding scholarship, educational and communal leadership, vitality, innovation, and a deep commitment to uphold Torah Umada. Our Rebbe said that he hoped that he would be a Talmud Chacham, not merely wise, but an eternal student of the wise. And we have chosen a Talmud Chacham. Dr. Norman Lamb possesses all these qualities and many more. He is a modern man, imbued with the sacred heritage of our past. It is to our credit that he was chosen president. May the sun always shine upon him. And that he has accepted the mantle of leadership of this great university. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present our president, whom we honor this day, Dr. Norman Lamb.
Mr. Chairman, members of the boards of Yeshiva University, distinguished guests of the academic community, fellow members of our faculties, my revered teachers, rabbis, my dear family, students, alumni, and friends of Yeshiva University, I am deeply moved by you who have assembled this day to join me in this ceremony of investiture as president of Yeshiva University. It is on this very platform that I received my doctorate just 10 years ago. Even more am I honored by the confidence placed in me by the trustees in entrusting to me the destiny of this great citadel of learning, which nurtured me intellectually and spiritually from the time I was 18 years old. However, this sentiment is tempered by two factors. First, I fully appreciate that it is not I, but Yeshiva University, which is being honored by you at this occasion. It is Yeshiva to which you and I express our gratitude for 91 years of unexcelled academic and communal leadership. Second, I feel humble indeed to have been summoned to follow two of the most innovative and gifted spiritual and educational leaders in the history of the American Jewish community, Dr. Bernard Revel of blessed memory, the first president of Yeshiva, and his successor and my immediate predecessor and teacher, Dr. Samuel Belkin. May he rest in peace. I revered Dr. Belkin as an inspired teacher. I loved him as a man, as a friend, and as my mentor. His giant mantle feels all too big on these narrow shoulders. Nevertheless, I am mindful of the saying of an ancient sage, Shmuel Bedoro Yiftach Bedoro. What the great Samuel was in his generation, the lesser Jephthah was in his generation. I know that I cannot equal my predecessors, I pray only that I may prove to be of as much service to my generation as they were to theirs. I suppose that every epoch produces its own Weltschmerz and issues its own solemn Jeremiads. Yet it is undeniable that depression and gloom and foreboding seem to be the hallmarks of our particular time. We are the generation of Vietnam and Watergate. Economic distress casts a pall over our country and indeed the world at the beginning of this, our third century. The United Nations, which began with so much promise, continues to lend the sanction of international respectability to terrorism and duplicity, and has soured mankind's hope into cynicism. And the State of Israel, which is for Jews the only institutionalized consolation to emerge out of the unspeakable horrors of the Holocaust, and for the Western world, the only shred of atonement for its sorry and sordid record during the war years, remains the only country in the world whose claim to national self-determination is questioned by most of the nations. At a time of such justifiable pessimism, there is much unhappiness, too, in the world of education. The position to which I have been called is no easy one, even in the most favorable of circumstances. Today, it is more difficult than it ever was before. The lead article in a recent current journal of higher education is entitled, "The Reeling Presidency." Yet, limited though we are by unpleasant realities, we must and will confront the future courageously. As the first century Rabbi Tarfon taught, you are not required to finish the task, but you are not free to desist from it. When the philosopher Immanuel Kant formulated his categorical imperative, he was asked if it is at all possible to abide by such a sublime code. He responded, "I don't know if it's practical, and I don't know if it's possible, but this I know, that du kannst, weil du musst, you can because you must." So maybe this isn't the best time, but it is the only time we have. And though society seems to be spinning and institutions seem to be tumbling and the world appears to be unstuck and university presidents are reeling, nevertheless, I shall do the only human and honorable thing. I shall try, I shall persevere, and with the help of God, we shall together prevail. Great American Admiral Halsey once said, "There are no great men, only great challenges which average men must somehow try to meet." So we can, because we must. I should like to address myself to some of the educational challenges which all of us confront. They are problems that are not necessarily unique to higher education or indigenous to Yeshiva University. They are also philosophical and societal and are reflected in the fact that a profound and hazardous confusion has insinuated itself into the prevalent philosophy of education in America. For an abrupt shift has taken place in the values that Americans place in education. A shift sharp enough almost to be termed a revolution. There was a time when the American emphasis on education seemed quite extravagant. In 1830, that perceptive French observer, Alexis de Tocqueville, wrote from America to a professor friend in Paris, "The universal and sincere faith that they profess here in the efficaciousness of education seems to me one of the most remarkable features of America." In retrospect, this faith seems so pure, so ingenuous, but soon it became quite disingenuous. For too long, American educationists and many colleges and universities mindlessly allowed themselves to fall into the trap of commercialism as they corrupted the educational enterprise with the clever hucksterism of Madison Avenue. In our pursuit of more education for more people, an ideal that is not only defensible but quite noble, we promise young men and women that a college degree will open for them the doors to higher pay and better jobs, that a sheepskin will produce more greenbacks, that a PhD will give them money and status. And as a result, Higher education has now been caught in its own trap. We promise that college is an investment in future earnings. And now suddenly we discover that the financial return after graduation on the investment of tuition, estimated only 5 years ago as between 11 and 12%, is now only slightly above 7%. Well, the inexorable logic of our deceptive appeals to materialistic motivations clearly leads to the conclusion that it is now wiser to invest in tax-free bonds than to go to school. It is because of this unfortunate linkage, both explicit and subliminal, between education and material rewards that in these last several years, Americans have begun to speak of certain people as being overeducated. My grandmother, God rest her soul, would have asked in her early Galician Yiddish, "It is a chisurn as the kala is ishein? Is it a shortcoming if the bride is too beautiful?" Now, I would not want this criticism to be overstated. I fully subscribe to the need for vocational preparation for young people so that they may gainfully be employed as adults. It is economically necessary, eminently reasonable, and for Jews who abide by the Jewish tradition, religiously mandatory. But speaking both as a committed Jew and as an academician, it is offensive, self-defeating, and dangerous to link career training with the purpose of study, to confuse culture with professionalism, to identify the beneficial economic consequences of the educational enterprise as its proper motive. This represents the antithesis and the undermining of true scholarship and is what the Talmud calls shelo lishma, study pursued for unworthy and dishonorable motives. I humbly suggest that Yeshiva University's distinctive philosophy of education has something of enduring value to contribute in this particular dilemma, not only to the Jewish community, but to American society in general. It is perhaps worthwhile to summarize briefly what we regard as our distinctive mission. The guiding vision of this university, as it was formulated by my two distinguished predecessors, was the philosophy of synthesis, the faith that the best of the heritage of Western civilization, the liberal arts and the sciences, was or could be made ultimately compatible with the sacred traditions of Jewish law and life, or at the very least that this dual program, with all its tensions, was crucial to the development of young Jews in an open society. The very name Yeshiva University symbolizes this article of faith. We see no essential conflict between our common humanity, shared with all people of all perceptions and all races, and our distinctive Jewishness, between the universalism of our intellectual pursuits and the commitment to the study of the heritage of Israel. Yeshiva University's role as the transmitter of two cultures and the creative development of both cultures is thus the first major element in Yeshiva's purpose. The second is quite simply the commitment to excellence. Now, the word excellence, of course, comes easy to the mouth of any educator. I do not know of any university that does not lay claim to the pursuit of excellence. Yet if I mention it here today, it is not so much to persuade you that we are excellent as to remind myself that the search for excellence lays a moral obligation upon me and my administration, that we must never cease from pursuing it, though we will never attain it in its fullness. Third and finally, what Yeshiva reaffirms for itself and what it must urge upon American society in general is the love of learning for its own sake, what in the Jewish tradition is known as Torah Lishma. It is this third principle that I believe must be invoked and implemented if higher education in this country is to be spared the humiliation of trivialization. Despite the acknowledgement by the bearers of our tradition of the need for vocational training, the theme of learning for its own sake remains a sacred goal, indeed, the preeminent value in all the tradition. Whereas in the sources, this theme of Torah Lishma refers exclusively to the study of the sacred literature, it becomes our duty to expand the concept from Torah to Chochmah, to secular knowledge, in the spirit of Saadia Gaon and Maimonides, so that the concept of learning for its own sake embraced not only sacred, but worldly wisdom as well. For ultimately, as that profound sage and gentle mystic poet Rav Kook taught, the holy of holies comprehends both the holy and the profane. It is this pursuit of learning for its own sake, without ulterior motives, this unadulterated love of the intellectual enterprise, that American universities must now more than ever before seek to inculcate in their students. Universities must, even while providing for career training, return to the original purpose of education, which is the transmission of culture and the advancement of knowledge for its own sake. We know this in our very bones in this time of crisis. I wish that the policymakers of our government knew this as well. If the present disengagement of government from support of education and research continues, it will be a long time indeed before America can again win so many Nobel Prizes in one year. Even self-interest, paradoxically, requires disinterested learning. The citizenry and government of America must learn that the cost of education is high, but the cost of ignorance is higher. We must learn that man is wedded to his intellect, and if he does not adequately provide for its upkeep, he may find that the alimony is even more onerous. I would be less than candid, indeed intellectually dishonest, if I stopped here. I might be more compassionate if I stopped here. For what I have said about learning for its own sake does not exhaust the full meaning of Torah Lishma. Is learning itself indeed going to save us? Can we afford the luxury of disengaged intellection and single-minded pursuit of research for its own sake in a society that seems to be undergoing a nervous breakdown? Dare we build ivory towers on the shifting sands of social instability and moral confusion? Contrary to what Socrates taught, the knowledge of the good does not by itself lead to its implementation. Education alone is not the answer to the world's ills. Uganda's Idi Amin may be an ignorant boor, but he was far outclassed by the scientists who performed human experiments in Nazi concentration camps and by the learned ideological hatchetmen of Stalinist Russia and Maoist China. Perhaps our crucial problem today is not the absence of education, but on the contrary, its growth without spiritual directions and ethical dimensions. The disparity between, on the one hand, man's technological progress made possible by his accelerated accumulation of knowledge, and on the other hand, his moral stagnation, goes back to the biblical tale of the Tower of Babel, those primitive builders who knew everything about bricks and mortar and nothing about heart and sensitivity and people, and yes, Dr. Nyquist, about love. That condition still obtains. Time has only exacerbated it, and friends, we are only 8 years away from 1984, the target date set for us by that modern prophet of doom, George Orwell. This disjunctiveness between technology and morality, between know-how and know-what, between education and ethical deterrence, is reflected in an agonizing existential paradox of contemporary man, a tremendous feeling of self-sufficiency and power, accompanied by a growing awareness of his own triviality, marginality, and insignificance. The more powerful he becomes, the more impotent he feels, and the more self-contempt he develops. The more he takes things into his own hands, the more he comes to believe that he possesses nothing but things, and that he is nothing but hands, and man soon becomes his own tools, heartless, soulless, pitiless, and ultimately even mindless. The philosopher Santayana wrote that men have come to power who, having no stomach for the ultimate, burrow themselves downward towards the primitive. So barbarism is in the air all about us. But Judaism has taught all of us, Jews and non-Jews alike, that even when learning is pursued for its own sake intellectually, it must never become an absolute, unrelated to moral dimensions. One must learn in order to do, and even if he learns for the sake of learning itself, it must be the kind of learning which makes him a different and better human being. King Solomon in Proverbs referred to Torah, the repository of Jewish teaching, as Eitz Chayim hi lamachazikim ba, it is a tree of life to them who take hold of it. Note that the famous king, whose wisdom was legendary despite the fact that he didn't have an earned doctorate, we only call him King Solomon, not Professor Solomon, the famed king chose as the symbol of learning only one of the two trees of the biblical Garden of Eden, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge. Surprisingly, he equated Torah, an intellectual pursuit, with a tree of life rather than that of knowledge. For true Torah is more than knowledge, it is life. True education is more than learning. It is human experience and neighborly love and elemental compassion as well. True intellect leads to more than concepts, it leads to reverence. And the mind in its furthest reaches must transcend the cognitive and lead to a humble sense of wonder. That learning must be more than knowledge, that it must enhance life, was expressed in a startlingly poignant way by the Zohar, the source book of the Kabbalah of Jewish mysticism. The biblical tree of knowledge, it taught, possessed within itself yet another tree, in Aramaic Ilana Demota, the tree of death. When man combines knowledge and life, he is capable of suppressing the tree of death. But if he pursues knowledge alone, unconcerned with the tree of life, with human compassion and love and gentleness, he thereby releases the noxious tree of death in all its many and ugly manifestations. The Zohar's insight is the anticipation of Huxley's Brave New World, a paradise turned into a hell. Education, then, must always strive for more than an arrogantly unresponsive quest for information or facts or knowledge alone. It must be concerned with the quality and dignity of human life. It is this enduring principle which is embodied in Yeshiva University and which we humbly suggest is worthy of consideration by a wider audience. Study for its own sake, not corrupted by base motivation and cheap commercialization, but also not study which ignores human dignity and morality and the quality of life. The life of the mind which avoids the extremes of intellectual sacrilege and academic idolatry. I have no doubt that there are many universities which subscribe to this ideal and strive with might and main to achieve it. Yeshiva University comes to this conclusion by extrapolating from the sources of the millennial tradition which gave birth to it and nourished it. It is a tribute to my beloved teacher, Dr. Samuel Belkin, Zechrono Livracha, that he deliberately built this institution according to this ideal pattern. How else explain the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where pure research in the frontiers of medicine and the biological sciences is wedded to the prevention and conquest of disease and infirmity? How else explain the theological seminary, Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, where the intricacies of Talmudic learning are integrated into the ideal of service to the young and the very old, the poor and the infirm, as well as to the community at large? How else explain the Wurzweiler School of Social Work, where social theory and humane practice go hand in hand, or the Belfer Graduate School of Science, or the Firkov School, or Anu Cardoza School of Law, or each of our 15 graduate and undergraduate divisions? Yeshiva's obligations to its student body and the Jewish community are self-evident. Its contributions to its third constituency, America and society at large, should be equally obvious. Not only in humanistic education and scientific research and medical and social and psychological community service, but also in the perennially relevant educational and philosophical insights it has culled from a tradition of study and teaching over the past 3,500 years. Permit me, friends, to close with a pledge and a prayer. To my alma mater, Yeshiva University, its faculties and students and trustees, I pledge all my strength and whatever modest talents and wisdom my Creator has granted me. I well know that no matter what I will do for Yeshiva, it will be inadequate to repay the infinite debt of gratitude I owe it for my own education. To the Jewish community, I pledge that I shall exert whatever influence this office confers upon me to advance the welfare of our folk and our faith, of Israel and Torah, in the special ways Yeshiva has perceived them, the ways of Torah u'Mada. Let the word go out from here that Yeshiva is entering a period of renewal, that here is and shall be the greatest Mekom Torah in the diaspora, even while we remain fully abreast of the wisdom of the world, that we will relate positively, warmly, and supportively to Medinat Yisrael with pride and without apology, for our destinies are intertwined and interlocked. To the world of scholarship, I pledge that this university will endeavor to the limits of its ability to contribute to the advancement of knowledge and research in all the areas of the sciences and humanities. To the community at large, I pledge to continue and augment our policies of communal service in the areas of health and welfare, striving for excellence and compassion, even in the face of political cynicism. To my dear father and mother, and my beloved wife and children, I pledge to try my best to bring honor to our family, to compensate, however inadequately, for the sacrifices that they must make to support my role in public life. Without their unquestioning faith in me and unswerving support of me throughout the years, I would never have been able to undertake these arduous burdens of communal and educational leadership. And with this pledge to my utterly devoted parents, for whom no sacrifice was too great for me, and to my life's mate, my always gracious and ever understanding, always patient and ever loving Mandela, and to my four dear and precious children who have made our family one of Torah and song and laughter, go my apologies for the difficulties my career has visited and yet may inflict upon them, and my gratitude for all they have done for me and meant to me throughout the years. And finally, a prayer. The Talmud tells us that one of the early sages, Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana, used to offer a special prayer when he came into the Beit HaMidrash, the academy. At such occasions, he would recite a special prayer for divine guidance. It is his prayer, which I now recite, as I am summoned to the presidency of Yeshiva University at the beginning of this last decade of its first century. Yehi ratzon milefanecha, Adonai Elohai, shelo ye'era devar takala al yadi, velo omar al tamei tahor, velo al tahor tamei, velo ikashel bidvar halacha, v'yismuchu bi chaverai, velo ikashlu chaverai bidvar halacha, v'esmach bahem. Be thy will, O Lord my God, that no mishap occur because of me, that I not pronounce as acceptable and pure that which is unacceptable and impure, that I not condemn as wrong that which is right, that I not err in matters of principle, and that my colleagues, trustees, philanthropists, educators, faculty, students, administrators, alumni, the community at large, have reason to be happy with me, And may they too never err in any important matter. And may I be privileged, O God, to be happy and joyous working with and for them. Kain yihi ratzon ben omar. Amen.
Please be seated for a moment. Lamb, we accept your challenge. V'heye bracha, may you be a blessing to all of us. Dear friends, this has been a very special day, and we are extremely gratified that so many of you joined us on this inspiring and historic occasion. We would acknowledge the presence of each of you, but I know that you consider that an impossibility, even as do I. But I would like to acknowledge the presence and to ask to rise so that we may acknowledge his presence. Of the Honorable Chaim Herzog, Ambassador, permanent representative of the State of Israel to the United Nations. Many of you have witnessed and have helped the extraordinary growth of Yeshiva University over the years. We hope that you will continue to help our growth, that you will visit our campuses when they are less crowded. We invite you even today to visit our beautiful museum across the street on Amsterdam Avenue. I understand that there's a wonderful new exhibit. We apologize for the inconvenience or discomfort which may have been occasioned by our desire to conduct these ceremonies in the locale which nurtured our president, and with so many members of the university family, it had to be held outdoors. We still don't have a field house or a large gymnasium. You are our family, and we know that you understand.
The benediction will be delivered by Rabbi Maurice Lamb, brother of our newly invested president, and spiritual leader of Beth Jacob Congregation in Beverly Hills, California. Will you please rise, Rabbi Lamb?
Baruch Atah, blessed are you, Lord our God, King of the universe, Shecholak Mechachmoso Lidayav, who has bestowed so generous a portion of his wisdom upon one who truly reveres him. In the narrow corridor of time between the demise of a great visionary president and the rise of a new scholar hero, we, the Bnei HaYeshiva, the sons and daughters of Yeshiva University, were oppressed with anxiety for the future of the school we love, of Jewish education in America, of modern orthodoxy, of the condition of the Jewish world. Today we thank you, O Lord, for it is a new, young day. Our vistas are broadened, our eyes are filled with excitement, and our hearts are buoyant with anticipation and with confidence as we celebrate the investiture of our new president. There is one dominant quality that has characterized my brother since our earliest days together, a quality he seeks to implant in the university as a whole, but one that was uniquely his among all the people I have ever known. It is the striving for excellence and the achieving of excellence in every undertaking of his mind and his heart. The very titles of the books he created are apt superscriptions of a series of qualities which you may not know, but which I, as his brother, assure you he excels in. First is the scholarship which makes him at home with Rudolf Otto, as with Reb Chaim Volozhiner, and is characterized by his book Torah Lishma, his landmark contribution to the community's Jewish education, characterized by tradition of Journal of Jewish Thought. His instinctive investigation of all of life, all his life, through the lens of the halacha, as illustrated by the Hedge of Roses. The unique magnificence of his deep commitment to God, unique for it is never smug and always humble, described so beautifully by Faith and Doubt. His breadth of vision and his courage to create, is characterized by his most famous sermon, The Royal Reach. But above all, the summa cum laude talent that he has for kindness and compassion and caring and integrity and honorableness and love and sheer gutzkeit, which is intellectually described by the Good Society. For no mother and father could have a more respectful son, and no wife, as Mindela can testify, more caring husband, and no children as Chai and Josh and Sholem and Sarah could have than my brother as a father, and no brother, as I and Tibby and Miriam can testify, can equal this man's brilliance and talent for goodness. There is this quality of excellence in religion as in science, in humanity as in the humanities, which he brings to bear in the historic and colossal task of leadership at Yeshiva University, which was emphasized and re-emphasized from this platform by every speaker, and which is a litany that we always will recite. For the founders of our yeshiva have dreamed the dream of the old patriarch for the new age, of a ladder reaching into the unexplored stratosphere, but which stands firmly on the bedrock of ancient Jewish values, upon which climb not angels today, but committed and sophisticated students who are familiar with the moon and Mars and the movement within the molecules, but who will be rooted and are rooted in Torah and Halacha, in compassion and love, in fairness and friendship and forgiving, and who will develop sensitive and generous spirits. The world Jewish community, arising from the nightmare of the Holocaust, could not survive the 20th century without that dream, for it equipped its young for living in a radically new world. My brother, the third president of Yeshiva, dreamed the dream of the third patriarch of our people. As a young man, as he moved from chemistry to the alchemy of the modern rabbinate, from the chair of philosophy to the university presidency, he will be the model of excellence in two worlds, after which thousands of rabbis and scholars and doctors and lawyers and physicists and students will pattern their own lives. Lincoln Steffens once wrote, "I have seen the future, and it works. We here today feel the future in our bones. The dream will not dissolve in the grim shadows of dawn's awakening. It will become reality, and in its progressive realization, all men will glory, Jews all over the world, men of goodwill everywhere, ki anoshim achim anachnu, for in pursuit of this goal, all of us are brothers of Dr. Lamb, and we say, Chazak v'amatz, may God give you strength, dear brother, lahagdil Torah ulha'adida, to make the Torah great and glorious with the help of Almighty God. Amen."